Hello, I'm Tom Metzger, your host on Race and Reason. Race and Reason is a show dedicated to free speech, a small island of free speech in a sea of controlled and managed news. In future shows, you will see many more controversial guests, and we will cover many controversial issues. But for today, we'll go to Dave Wiley, my co-host, and he will introduce our guest.
Dave? Well, thank you, Tom. To my left is Mike Brown, who's the author of a book called Brown's Lawsuit Cookbook, and he was also the bodyguard for George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the founder of the American Nazi Party, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I see.
Good day. You're quite a colorful person from what I hear. Back in the days of when George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazi Party, was making a lot of tours, giving a lot of speeches and so forth, and I understand you were his bodyguard. And tell us about those days.
I was his bodyguard at his college speeches. I was not with him when he got killed. In fact, he had left me in California the year before because he couldn't afford to feed me. And he left me in charge of the Oakland unit of the American Nazi Party.
Well, what about the this Wheels of Rage and the Iron Cross Motorcycle Club? Tell us about that.
Okay, the Iron Cross Motorcycle Club evolved about a year after Rockwell's death. There were two factions in the American Nazi Party. There were the pure Nazis and the religious fanatics. And all the religious fanatics left with me and formed the Iron Cross Motorcycle Club. And we rode here in Southern California from 1968 to 1970, and we basically did the same thing that we had done under Rockwell, punching out peace parades. Fellow, you know that we call Muskrat, and another guy and I, we had a very interesting 45-minute gunfight down in East Los Angeles. We got dynamited. They were fun times.
Back in the good old days,
huh? Right.
I've heard you talk about riots that you've been in where demonstrators were throwing rocks at your vehicle in the middle of a crowd, and there were demonstrators on the other side throwing rocks at your car, and the rocks were going over and hitting people and knocking them out, the demonstrators, and you've been really through some fun things.
Well, that incident you're referring to took place around November of 1966 in San Francisco. Rockwell was giving a speech from his camper. I was the point man for the 26 men that we had there, and everybody was trying to throw rocks and bricks and bottles at Rockwell. The problem is they were on both sides of his camper, and these missiles went both ways. They never hit him, but boy, did they lay people out in the streets. There were more accidents happen that day than I've ever seen before or since.
Were you at his Brown University speech?
No, that was before my time. I accompanied him in all his speeches here in California in late 1966 and early 1967. And then whenever he would come through here, then my people would act as escorts when I was in Oakland.
Actually, the show is about Mike here, but it is interesting. Rockwell was a very colorful and dynamic type person. How did you see George Lincoln Rockwell in your own eyes, working close to him?
Rockwell had the one thing that very few of our people have. He understood that loyalty went both ways. The first time I got arrested for a street fight up in San Francisco, they bagged 11 of us. We'd attacked 60,000 people, and of course they arrested us. And the first thing Rockwell did was call him and say, what do I have to pawn to get Brown out? I mean, the guy inspired the type of loyalty in his troops that I've never seen before or since.
Well, certainly you must have been doing these things for more than fun. I mean, who would just, you know, you don't just go to a bar and say, hey, let's form the Nazi Party.
Well,
and go out and have some fun. I mean, it has to be
Well, this was during the Vietnam War era.
That's correct. And most of the time we were attacking these peace marches, and we attacked several. In fact, one of them that we were so successful in attacking, we ran into the Progressive Labor Party division of the Longshoremen's Union. We slugged it out over two city blocks for about two full minutes. That was such a Donnybrook that it made national headlines all over the United States.
Well, did you feel the peace movement was communistic or inspired in some way that you didn't like?
Yeah. Well, we sort of had that impression when the people were flying Viet Cong flags and wearing black pajamas and coolie hats. And the first street fight we went out in, we got seven other Viet Cong flags, and they had a big banner that said victory for the Viet Cong, and I tore that down. And that's basically why we attacked those people.
Probably, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, do you feel it was more of a support for the men fighting and dying in Vietnam and not so much for the suicidal policies of our own government?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that in retrospect that all they did was use Vietnam as a slaughterhouse for the best of our own kind. And without trying to digress from the subject, you'll notice the same year the Vietnam War ended, which they were used as a culling program to get rid of our best, that's the year the Supreme Court legalized abortions, because nobody would hold still for another Vietnam War right off the bat.
And so you're very much opposed to abortion, too, as one of your arguments.
That's correct. I did 3.5 years in prison because of my beliefs on abortion.
Do you feel that abortion is a form of a genocide in some way? And what type of genocide do you believe?
Well, it's absolutely genocide, because since 1972, Harry Blackmun wrote the opinion that legalized abortion in this country, we have lost 18 million American citizens. By the turn of the century, the 21st century, we will be missing 42 million American citizens, of which 8 million would have been men of draft age.
And where a majority of these people would have been white people?
Oh, probably 98%.
Mm-hmm.
See, what we've got is we're actually in the middle of a war, and nobody realizes that. We're losing the equivalent of a regiment of infantry every day.
So you, I know in the beginning you were in the military, the 101st Airborne, 82nd Airborne, and then
right.
You worked with George Lincoln Rockwell. And then after his assassination, you had the Iron Cross Motorcycle Club for a while, and then what happened there?
Well,
you've had quite a history.
Well, basically, by the middle of 1970, we ran out of people to punch.
Mm-hmm.
During the Vietnam War, there were these whole armies out there that we could attack. And by 1970, quite frankly, nobody gave a damn.
Didn't they ever attack you, or did you have to attack them?
No, we could never get them to do that. In fact, in one incident that I'm sure Muskrat's told you about, we were up at the Black Panther headquarters in Oakland, California, and we stood out there with a big sign with rifles and shotguns and revolvers, and this was 2 weeks after they had invaded the California legislature. We had a big sign saying, "Who needs niggers?" And when does the riot begin? And the reporters that watched us back them down, and nobody has to say, okay, this guy's just bragging about backing them down. It's a matter of public record. It's on the films up there showing them, saying, you know, we don't want any problems. The reporters came up to us and says, well, what if they picket in front of your house? And I just said, fine, there they are. You go tell them. Bring them on. And that was the end of it. Nothing ever happened.
Well, I've heard of some of those wild experiences of the Oakland Suicide Squad.
That's what they call us, right?
The Oakland Suicide Squad.
Right.
And that was composed of what, a dozen men?
We had 54 the morning before our first street action. That morning we had 9.
I understand that you also lived for some time, the so-called Oakland Suicide Squad, in actually the black area of the city. The black neighborhood.
There wasn't anything else in Oakland.
Oh, okay.
In fact, there was a black whorehouse right next to us, and the guy made the mistake of trying to roll on one of my boys, and the guy just took a 59 Ford and ran over him with it.
Did you fly a swastika out the front door?
Not out the front door, but we had it hanging in the living room where anybody driving within 50 yards of the place could have seen it. They knew who.
Well, certainly you must have had some philosophical reason for doing what you do. I mean, What is the philosophy that's within you that inspired you to take up these various roles and commit these actions? You know?
Okay.
What makes a soldier a soldier?
That's a soldier for whom?
Okay, now that's an excellent question, see, because you're asking a philosophical question, and I was not a philosopher. I was one of George Lincoln Rockwell's lieutenants, and if that man came back here tomorrow, if he wanted to lead a Boy Scout troop in pink underwear, I'd follow him. In other words, that man had that kind of charisma. That's why they called us the Oakland Suicide Squad, is because we'd have died for him.
So you believe basically in the leadership principle.
That's correct, provided that the leader himself is not doing something that's inimical to the best interests of American citizens or my own kind.
But you're a man of strong convictions. Where did you go from there? What was the next stop of your political activism, as they would say today?
Okay, after Rockwell got hit, in fact, Ralph Forbes, who was a captain in the American Nazi Party at the time, and I, we had been to Arlington, Virginia for a conference in June of 67. And on the way back, I told him, if Rockwell buys it, none of the rest of us have what it takes to make this thing succeed. So after he got killed, I hung on for about a month or two. I saw the individual who's in charge now making one stupid bungle after another, so I just walked out of it. In fact, quite frankly, the heart went out of me. And about a year later, some of the people who had been with me said, well, you know, Brown, we got to do something. I said, well, fine, let's start a motorcycle club, because then we can run around with the swastikas and all the neat stuff, and nobody will realize how really rotten and evil we really are. And we did that for about 2 years. We kept punching out peace parades, and we got even further into acts of violence, gunfights, dynamitings, things like that. And because there were so many of us, and we were so determined to look out for each other, that we'd, for example, one time we went to kidnap a guy, put him in the back of the truck, beat the crap out of him. There's 100 witnesses. Cops never even came to question us. Nobody wanted to testify. And by July of 1970, we had simply run out of enemies. There just wasn't anything left.
See, Dave, you got a different kind of a guest today. You're not used to this, are you?
No, actually, I'm rather shocked.
This is free speech.
Well,
want free speech? We give you free speech.
I asked for free
speech.
Yeah, right. But I mean, so far I've heard about all the actions, but you know, I mean, basically, I'm a philosophically oriented person, which is why I'm doing this as opposed to being out on the street, perhaps.
And he's not. He's not.
He's a man of action.
Right.
But well,
obviously, he has a basic.
I mean, there's
philosophy.
There's certain issues. I mean, that, you know, bring emotion out in someone. For instance, like abortion. I think we mentioned that before. I mean, I'm pretty much against abortion myself. I know that there's a. There's people out there right now. In fact, there's quite a stir. The feminists who are promoting the abortion, you know, they're pretty upset because there was 24 incidents of either fires or some minor fire or some little bomb or firecracker that goes off nearby or on the premises in these clinics. And, of course, that's, you know, 24 incidents out of, you know, what, 8,000 arsons per year, but they're real upset. They feel they're being picked on, which I suppose they are to some degree. But
It's genocide, isn't it? I mean, people talk to me about the whether you believe in the Jewish genocide thing or whether you don't. Say if it was true, it was from what I can gather from 1971 until now, there's been about 16 million babies aborted.
18 million.
But I guess what you're saying is that you see an issue and then you become a person of action as opposed to a person of talk.
That's correct. The only reason I'm not out there blowing up abortion clinics myself right now is that when I had 10 years that I was doing in Lewisburg and a federal judge cut it to 5, I gave him my word of honor that I would not put any more dynamite in any more buildings. And, boy, he just ruined my whole career.
Well, talking about this, what about your move against the United Nations? Back years ago, a lot of people opposed the United Nations, and they were looked on as weird. And all of a sudden, since Israel had problems with the United Nations, suddenly it's become popular to be against the United Nations. But I understand you were against the United Nations a little stronger back in those days.
What I actually had was I had a contract job that was given to me by Lieutenant General Pedro del Valle to take down a statue of the ancient Canaanite god Baal that sits in the United Nations building. It's mislabeled Poseidon. Poseidon's got a beard and a trident. He sits down. This guy's got up, looks like he's hurling a Tootsie Roll. And what happened was I was going to take the place by frontal assault. We had dynamite, thermite, semi-automatic weapons. And since I didn't have my California people like Muskrat with me, I went with the second string, and the second string all chickened out. And when the FBI got me, the only reason they had any evidence is because I had laid in all the supplies to go back and do the job right by myself. You know, I had the blasting
cap. What was this, the so-called chapel in the UN, or what?
No, see, they have in the main vestibule of the United Nations building, there's a statue in there that is the ancient Canaanite god Baal. Now, the reason that that statue's there, and the reason Del Valle wanted it down, is that that's the ancient Canaanite god they used to sacrifice all the kids to. In other words, they take a newborn baby and put it in a pot and put it in the foundation of their house, and that was supposed to bring them good luck, okay? And I think Del Valle had figured out that that's basically what a lot of these people in this country are doing. Because everything that you do, as far as governments go, is basically a religion, whether it's atheist, humanist, Christian, agnostic, or whatever. And our government has set a policy of sacrificing unborn children to who knows what.
You were mentioning before about a tremendous amount of abortions leaving a big hole in the working population to bring in people from other countries. I've noticed the same people that say we need to control a birth are the same people who want to bring in third world people to take their places, saying we don't have enough manpower.
Yeah.
Strange.
There is a strange use for fetuses. Now, it's probably not the reason why there's so much abortion, but you never know. They use the skin of aborted fetuses, and at least in one French cosmetic factory, to extract a certain chemical that the women over there can put on her face, and it rejuvenates her skin or something like that. So there is a commercial, there is a market for
fetuses.
Has that
been validated? I mean, you hear a lot of charges. I mean, is that, you know, is that just some rumor you heard? I mean,
I've heard that rumor for a good 8 months now. And
well,
I've heard people, I've seen people pick up the magazines on television and read it right out of the French magazines where it was supposed to be.
Well, I do know here in Los Angeles, they opened that warehouse where there was so many thousand.
16,000 fetuses.
Fetuses. And
waiting to go somewhere.
Arguing what they're going to do with them, whether to bury them or what. So, I mean, I don't understand the thing of people talking about genocide all the time. And
abortion would make sense if you can find some market for fetuses. Because if there's a high price for fetuses and somebody can buy them and they get the women to pay for the abortion, they take the fetuses, do God only knows what. But it would, then abortion would make sense. But as it is, if there's no money...
The twisted logic of the thing is what I'm talking about.
Well, the problem is, though, is that I think we're about to stick our foot in it here. The Department of Health and Human Services in Washington, our benevolent government, does have a use for aborted fetuses. They're keeping some of them alive so they can pull organs out of them. Okay?
Oh, that's another thing.
Okay, now, you've heard about Nazi Germany and how, you know, it's so awful we... gassed 6 million Jews, supposedly.
Abortion was illegal in...
18 million American citizens have gone down the tubes in the last 12 years, and I'm going to put out a poster. It's going to have a picture of Harry Blackmun, the Supreme Court Justice, that wrote the decision in Roe versus Wade that legalized abortion in this country. And underneath it, I want to have a picture of Adolf Hitler, and it's going to say in big letters, when you're only number two, you try harder.
We'd like to pause at this time, and if you've joined us late, this is Race and Reason, a provocative, controversial show, we hope, an island of free speech in that sea of managed news. And if you'd like to write us, our address will run at the end of the show, or if you'd like to write our guests, their address will run at the end of the show, and we invite you to write us. And if you'd like to be on the show, write us. Possibility one of these days you could be on the show, too.
Well, which bombing incident were we talking about?
I only planted one bomb.
and then you went to prison, and you did your time, and there where we pick up the track here.
Well, actually, I've been sort of inactive.
What happened here in the prison?
Well, I became a jailhouse lawyer because in Terre Haute Federal Prison, otherwise known as the Gladiator School, there were only two things I could learn. One was knife fighting. I've seen 14 men stabbed to death, and the other was law. Because the day I got to Terre Haute, they shipped me from Lewisburg when I was being trained by a jailhouse lawyer there. They had to break it up. They didn't have a library in this doggone prison.
And this is a book you wrote?
That's correct. I've had several cases published in the Federal Reporters. I've had two cases go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. They were both denied certiorari. But that was before I realized what denied certiorari meant. In other words, when the Supreme Court refuses to review a case in this day and age, it doesn't mean the case isn't important. It means they are trying to shield it from review by Congress, because Congress can reverse them.
And you don't find that lawyers are too respectable in this country? Is this what you're trying to say?
Lawyers are the maggots of a civilization.
I think this man speaks with a straight tongue.
Well, I always wondered, Tom, why haven't they ever written a law in plain English that people can read without having to have it interpreted? And it seems like it's interpreted one way one year, and then they interpret the law another way another year. You could read the law. You never know what's going on.
Doesn't that go back to...
How about a contract? Can you understand any contract that's ever been written
difficult,
by a lawyer?
But doesn't that go back to the rhetoricians of Greece, the word rhetoric coming out of, where people had It got complicated, and the average guy had to go out and hire himself a rhetorician. He'd go down and plead his case.
It goes farther back than
even
that.
Farther than that.
It goes back to Babylon when they came up with what was known as the Babylonian Talmud. Okay?
And you don't hear much about that book, or that 23 volumes, I guess.
Okay. Well, the reason you don't is because they started the same nonsense in Babylon that our Supreme Court has started now. And that instead of taking the plain meaning of something, they said, well, we have to interpret it. And that they got interpretations on top of interpretations. And by about the 3rd century A.D., everybody realized, well, this Talmud, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with anything. But we haven't realized, like, the language of our Constitution is quite plain. But what happens is these federal judges, and there is no one group that is more responsible for the nonsense in this country than the federal judiciary. I'll give you an example. This judge that got killed down in Texas, Woods. Now, I worked on a couple of the cases that he had. There were a couple of Mexicans that bunked next to me. And one of them said, well, he just sent us to prison for 10 and 20 years with no corroborating evidence, the uncorroborated testimony of one snitch. And I said, I'll tell you what. I said, everybody that goes to prison, there's what it says in their transcript, and they said, it's, you know, what they say, okay? I said, if you're telling me the truth, I'll take your case free for nothing. And honest to God, I opened this thing up. There was not one shred of evidence against either one. And these were just kids at like 18, 19 years old.
Yes.
Woods gave them 10 and 20 years for conspiracy to distribute narcotics. I mean, these kids didn't even smoke. And here they are in a federal prison because their two lawyers said, well, let's go in front of this judge and we won't have to have a jury trial. Well, the lawyers wanted their $500. They wanted to get it out of the way in 2 hours, and bingo, these two kids go to prison. And quite frankly, when he got hit, I figured the guy that did it should have been given a medal.
That brings us to this point. Is there any rehabilitation going on in the prisons? And are there a lot of political prisoners in this country?
The answer to the first question is no. You cannot rehabilitate somebody that is being treated unfairly on a daily basis. Now, we're not talking about your average Boy Scout in these places. You know, we're talking about society's little misfits. But by the same token, they are American citizens, and as such, they should be entitled to the same rights and protections as the rest of us. Now, they don't get it. So what happens is when they come out of prison, the whole prison system in this country is set up for repeat business, just like any other business. When you send a guy outside of a prison, and I've seen this happen after 10 years behind the walls, I mean, the guy doesn't even feed himself, all right? He doesn't wash his own clothes. He doesn't have to worry about making a living. Maybe he'll work in the prison industry. You turn a guy like this loose after 10 years with $30 in his pocket, he doesn't even know where to start. So he goes and robs a bank, back he goes. In other words, it's set up for repeat business.
It's a part of the law business.
That's correct. It's a very lucrative racket. The corruption that I saw when I was in, it was just, it would literally take hours to describe. In fact, there are more crimes committed within the walls of a federal prison than there are on the streets by the guys who got put there.
And the other question would be on political prisoners, no matter what race or what belief or what. I happen to believe there's a lot of political prisoners in our country. Our government would not admit that we have political prisoners in this country.
Oh, there's more than you think. What happens is any time somebody gives... Now, one of the things you have to understand about the government, this is both federal and state, is that our legal system has evolved or devolved, whatever you want to call it, to the point that the government is no longer concerned with protecting its citizens. It is only concerned with protecting itself, which is why some baby raper out here gets 2 years and some guy that does something that the government thinks is horrendously inimical to its own interests.
Counterfeiting or something like that.
How about a guy puts a bomb in a U.N. building? I got 25 years.
Yeah.
Okay? The government is just, and you can watch this. You can go into any courtroom in the United States, and you watch the kind of guys are turning loose. Child molesters, axe murderers. Well, maybe I'm being a little facetious, all right?
Yeah.
Stick-up artists. But the people who have done things that interfere or that the government thinks interfere with our operation are the ones who get the maximum time.
It seems like you've
it's
had
too audacious to screw with them.
A lot of self-education and something that... I don't know. I guess fortunately, a lot of people don't get the opportunity to have to go to prison, but I think the American people have to understand, at least I understand, I think you understand, that the prisons are pretty bad and they really don't rehabilitate anyone. And it's a lot of it's a money-making business, and it's a revolving door. If you go down to the courtrooms in any major city, you see poor people who don't have any money being just shuffled out, and these cheap lawyers just collecting the bucks. Well, you came out of that, what next? What happened? I understand you went to, what, Kentucky, and then...
I lived in Kentucky before I was arrested, and I went back there. And
now we're getting to this part of the show that you've been waiting on, Dave.
Okay.
What happened? What happened to you in Kentucky? We got 3 minutes here.
Okay.
And then what happened now in Utah?
Okay, well, what happened in Kentucky was I got out, and I've got to misbehave in some fashion, or life isn't worth living, and I became Kentucky's only practicing polygamist. And my mother asked me to leave town, and I said, okay, so I moved to Salt Lake City. I had two old ladies and, at the time, I think 6 kids.
It sounded like prison reform, this guy.
Yeah.
I just aimed me off in another direction.
So you became a polygamist, and you're a practicing polygamist today. Is that true?
Not at the moment. The number two, her parents kept getting on her case about how evil this whole situation was, so she finally went back to Illinois. But the good book says I'm entitled to 7, and right now I'm 6 short.
Sounds like to me you're just a militant libertarian of some type, huh?
Well, you know, you got to do something to make life worth living. If you work 9 to 5 and do everything the government wants you to do, I'd rather be back in prison.
Well, I don't know where I could get away with that, Dave. I don't know if my wife would let me, but you're not married. You have possibilities.
Well, I don't think I would take prison to any other alternative. I think I'd go without, at least for a while.
Are you saying it's much better to be a polygamist than be in jail?
Oh, probably. I would definitely say that it's far better to be. Well, I don't know. It depends on the situation, I guess, if they had you tied up. And not literally, but I mean if...
I think we're covering a lot of ground here. We covered a lot of good ground. I think it's something for people who don't know about people like Mike. He's very colorful in his past, and he put himself right where he believed he ought to be, and he took action. He didn't sit around reading books all the time. You know, we have to have our readers, and we have to have our soldiers. And he is a true soldier. And I think maybe someday they may make a movie out of somebody like you. What about that book, Wheels of Rage?
Right now it's in the hands of the guy that made Mad Max and the Road Warrior, and they may make a movie out of it.
Boy, that would be good.
Did you ever read that book?
No, I didn't, to be perfectly honest. I didn't get a hold of one.
Doesn't Muskrat have a copy?
I'm not sure, but I'll tell you one thing. If it's anything like Mad Max, it's got to be good.
Oh, it's 10 times better. Ours was real.
You have another question before we close?
No, I think... I've heard it all today.
No, you haven't heard it all.
No. He'll come back. He'll come back for the exciting stuff.
Okay.
Mike Brown, it's been good to have you on the show. And thank you, our audience, for being with us. Stay tuned. You'll see a lot of exciting shows like this in the future. Write us. You'll see our address at the end of the show. And thank you for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.